Welcome to the History Maps podcast. You know, when you look at the blueprints for a machine, say a combustion engine or an automated assembly line, you expect cold, hard logic.
Right. Parts move, fuel burns. It just does what it's built to do.
Exactly. Energy transfers, and the machine produces a reliable, predictable output. It's purely mechanical. It doesn't care about the moral character of the mechanic.
Yeah, and it certainly doesn't care if the individual parts are happy.
No, not at all. So today we are taking a deep dive into a stack of historical texts, academic analyses from modern scholars, and some pretty intense ancient philosophical manuscripts. We're looking at a framework called legalism, or phygeia.
And this is a fascinating topic because it's basically taking that exact same mechanical logic, that total disregard for morality and sentiment, and applying it to a population.
Right, using it as the blueprint for an entire human society. So our mission for this deep dive is to unpack what happens when you do that. We're going to explore how these ancient political theorists essentially engineered the first unified Chinese empire.
And why that exact same rigid engineering caused the empire to rapidly collapse just a few years later.
Yeah, the timeline is wild.
Yeah.
And finally, we'll look at how the bureaucratic DNA of legalism survives in the institutions you and I interact with in the modern era. So to really understand the mechanics of this power structure, I feel like we have to understand the environment that produced it.
Oh, absolutely. You can't separate the philosophy from the chaos of the time. The sources really focus on the Warring States period, which runs from roughly 475 to 221 BCE.
Okay, so a period of just constant conflict.
Exactly. But prior to this, during the Zhou dynasty, China operated on a very decentralized feudal system.
Right.
Rulers held power through complex webs of aristocratic privilege, kinship ties, and, you know, shared rituals.
So if I'm a ruler during the Zhou dynasty, my authority basically rests on the fact that I am related to the right people, right? And that I perform the right ceremonies of the ancestral temples.
Yeah. Exactly. It was heavily reliant on mutual obligation. It was a shared aristocratic culture. But by the 5th century BCE, that system had totally deteriorated.
It just broke down.
Completely. The Zhou domain fractured into numerous independent, highly aggressive states, and they were all engaged in this brutal struggle for survival.
And the texts point out that the scale of warfare escalated in a way that fundamentally altered the political reality.
Right. We are no longer talking about small bands of aristocrats fighting formalized chariot skirmishes.
Where there were rules of engagement and honor codes, right?
Yeah.
Like a gentleman's war.
Yeah, exactly. Those days were gone. We are talking about mass mobilization. States were fielding infantry armies numbering in the hundreds of thousands.
I want to pause on that logistical reality for a second because, you know, fielding an army of 500,000 soldiers is not just a matter of handing out weapons.
Not at all. The logistics are staggering.
Right. You need immense agricultural output. You need highly efficient taxation and basically total control over the population.
Yeah.
You cannot mobilize that many people by just asking nicely.
No, or by relying on ancient kinship rituals. The administrative burden was unprecedented.
So it was adapt or die.
Literally. If a state failed to maximize its agricultural yield, it couldn't feed its army. And if it couldn't feed its army, it would be conquered.
And its ruling house would just be extinguished.
Extinguished, yeah. Moral exhortations and reliance on the goodwill of noble families, that just wasn't sufficient anymore. Rulers needed concrete, empirical methods to extract every possible ounce of resources from their territory.
And that desperation, that need for efficiency, is the cauldron that produced the thinkers we later grouped together under the label of phygeia.
Right. And we should probably clarify that term for the listener based on the text.
Yeah, let's do that. Because phygeia is commonly translated into English as legalism, but the sources indicate that this label is actually a bit of a historical illusion.
It is. The term phygeia did not even exist during the Warring States period itself.
Wait, really? So they didn't call themselves legalists?
No, not at all. It's a retrospective categorization. It was actually invented by Han Dynasty historians, specifically Sima Tan, around 110 BCE.
Okay, so hundreds of years later.
Right. He was trying to organize the imperial library and make sense of the past, so he categorized the various thinkers of the classical age into 6 major schools of thought.
Okay, so the men we call legalist figures, the texts identify as Shang Yang, Shen Buhai, Shen Dao, and Han Fei. they didn't hold meetings or consider themselves part of a unified movement.
Exactly. They lived at different times, they served in different states, and they advocated varying methods.
I mean, some were cheese ministers actually running governments, while others were just scholars analyzing power.
Yeah, so what linked them was not a shared identity. It was a shared orientation.
A very specific mindset.
Right. They were all theorists or practitioners of a realistic, deeply immoral brand of statecraft.
Aimed purely at consolidating the power and wealth of the state.
And the autocratic ruler, yes.
Now, amoral is a heavy word. To fully grasp how radical this orientation was, let's contrast them with their contemporaries.
That's a good idea. The intellectual landscape of the time is often called the era of the 100 schools of thought.
Because everyone was trying to solve the crisis of the warring states.
Right. It was a marketplace of ideas. And the most prominent were the Confucians, the Ru.
Okay, so what was their pitch?
Well, the Confucians believed the state was fundamentally a moral community. They held a regressive view of history.
Meaning they looked backwards.
Exactly. They believed society had declined from a past golden age governed by perfect sage kings.
Okay, so for a Confucian, the solution to the chaos of the warring states was moral cultivation.
Right. Through benevolence, known as ren, and strict adherence to traditional ritual propriety, known as lai.
So a virtuous ruler would inspire virtue in the people. It sounds like they believe that if the king acts like a good father, the subjects will act like good children.
That's a great way to summarize it. And then you had other groups, like the Mohists.
Founded by Modi. The sources describe them as sort of grassroots activists advocating for universal love and measurable welfare for the common people.
Right, consequentialist welfare.
Yeah.
And they completely rejected the elitist rituals of the Confucians as wasteful.
Like, why are we spending money on fancy funerals when people are starving, that kind of thing.
Exactly. And you also had early Taoist thinkers. They argued for non-action, a return to natural simplicity, and basically a rejection of artificial state impositions entirely.
Yeah, they felt that the more laws you made, the more thieves you created.
Right. But the legalists looked at all of this, the Confucian obsession with the past, the Mohist universal love, the Taoist retreat to nature, and essentially concluded that this was totally useless.
Useless for actually running a state that is literally fighting for its life.
Precisely. The legalists viewed history descriptively, not regressively.
Meaning they looked at how things actually are right now.
Yes. Han Fei, who we can think of as the grand synthesizer of legalist thought, he lived in the 3rd century BCE. He pointed out that society was not morally worse than it used to be.
It was just different.
Right.
The sources mention a really specific demographic argument Han Fei made, which I found so interesting. He noted that in ancient times, people might have seemed generous, but that was just because the population was small.
And resources were abundant.
Right. So he argued that in his day, people fought and stole not because human nature had suddenly decayed, but because the population had exploded and resources were scarce.
It is a purely materialist analysis. Mouths are many, resources few. That was his quote.
I see. So quoting ancient sage kings or trying to replicate the governance of a sparsely populated past is completely irrelevant.
Because the material conditions have changed, so the methods of government must change.
This makes me think about how we design systems today. I mean, if the Confucians were constantly looking backward to a mythical golden age for their solutions, the legalists were essentially treating the state as a utility-maximizing machine.
A machine that needed to be optimized for the present reality.
Right, rather than treating it as a moral community.
They were social engineers. Where other philosophies focused on the personal arts, the moral character, or the charisma of the individual ruler, the legalists were attempting to design foolproof, mechanically reliable institutions.
They wanted a system that would function regardless of whether the ruler sitting on the throne was a genius or a total fool.
Exactly. The system itself had to be the source of strength.
Okay, but to engineer a system like that, you have to build it on a specific foundation. You have to make a core assumption about the material you are working with.
Right.
And in this case, the material is human beings. This brings us to the legalist view of human nature, which really seems to be the engine driving their entire political machine.
It absolutely is. Legalists posited that human nature, what they called exing, is inherently self-interested.
Just completely selfish.
Pretty much. They believe humans are driven by two primal instincts, the desire for profit, or li, and the avoidance of harm, or hai.
So they just completely rejected the Confucian idea that people are naturally inclined toward goodness.
Yeah, they threw that right out.
Or that they can be morally cultivated through education and ritual.
They viewed that kind of optimism as lacking any empirical support. Hanfei used parables to show that people will always prioritize personal advantage over altruism.
Unless there is a tangible incentive to do otherwise.
Right. Shan Yang, an earlier legalist practitioner, stated flatly that humans are intrinsically selfish and covetous.
Wow. Okay. So if you accept the premise that humans are purely selfish, utility-maximizing creatures, you cannot govern them by asking them to be good.
No, moral pleading doesn't work.
You have to govern them by manipulating their selfishness. You have to use incentives.
And the mechanism for delivering those incentives is fei.
Okay, fei. Now, fei is usually translated as law, hence the term legalism. But the sources point out that this translation is actually quite misleading.
It is, yeah. In ancient Chinese, fei carried a much broader connotation. It meant models or standards.
Like physical tools?
Exactly. The stock examples used by these thinkers were the carpenter's compass and set square, the level, or the merchant's standard, weights and measures.
Okay, let's thread this idea with the machine blueprint metaphor from earlier. A compass doesn't judge you.
Right.
It simply dictates what a perfect circle is. So fat is conceptually closer to an objective performance standard.
Yes. It's a set of explicit public rules that regulate behavior, backed by rigorous incentives for success and disincentives for failure.
It functions very much like a modern computer algorithm.
That's a really good analogy.
I mean, an algorithm doesn't care if you had a bad day, it doesn't care about your noble intentions, and it doesn't care who your parents are. It simply applies a rule impartially.
If input A happens, output B is executed.
Right. And Shang Yang implemented fa in the state of Qin between 359 and 338 BCE precisely like that, didn't he?
He did. And this was revolutionary because prior to this, the aristocracy often received special treatment.
Because of their bloodlines.
Exactly. High-ranking nobles could avoid harsh punishments, perhaps being offered the option of suicide instead of public execution, just to preserve their dignity.
Oh.
But Shang Yang eradicated those privileges entirely. Fa was applied equally to everyone, from the highest minister to the lowest peasant.
Okay. Equality under the law sounds nice on paper, but the outputs of this algorithm, the rewards and punishments, were severe. The texts mention the five traditional punishments.
Yes. To manipulate a purely self-interested population, the deterrence must be absolute. The punishments included tattooing the face, cutting off the nose, chopping off one or both feet, castration, and death.
I am reading this and trying to imagine the physical reality of a society where the state algorithm dispenses that kind of violence for minor offenses.
It's brutal.
Chopping off a foot because someone violated a minor administrative standard? It is a calculus of total terror.
It really was. But Shang Yang argued that if you apply severe penalties to minor infractions, people will be too terrified to ever commit major crimes.
It's the ultimate deterrence theory.
Exactly. But the enforcement mechanism is where the system becomes highly intrusive. Shang Yang instituted a system of mutual responsibility.
Oh, right, the household group.
Yes. He organized the population into groups of 5 or 10 households. If one person in that group committed a crime, the entire group was punished, sometimes with death or mutilation.
Unless they reported the offender.
Right.
Hold on, let me make sure I'm picturing this right on a village level. Let's say I live next door to a guy who steals a chicken.
Okay.
The state algorithm dictates that if I do not report him, my nose is cut off along with his.
Yes, that's exactly how it worked.
So the algorithm of fei forces me to become an active agent of the state's surveillance network just to protect my own body. It turns the entire population into an interlocking grid of snitches.
It does. It forces compliance by making vigilance a shared mortal obligation. The algorithm of fei extended into the very fabric of the community, basically overriding any natural bonds of friendship or neighborliness.
You can't trust anyone.
No one. But Fa also had a positive output. Hanfei emphasized that punishments must be mirrored by robust, reliable rewards.
Right, the carrot and the stick. And the sources say these rewards were usually tied directly to the state's primary needs.
Yeah.
Agricultural output and military success.
Yes. In the Qin military system, ranks and land were awarded based on the verifiable number of enemy heads a soldier took in battle.
Literally counting decapitated heads.
Literally. If you met the standard of fa, the algorithm dispensed wealth and status. If you failed, it dispensed pain or death. The standards were public, clear, and absolutely unavoidable.
Okay, so the peasants and the soldiers are locked into this matrix of rewards and punishments. They're terrified of fa, but what about the guys holding the whips?
The officials.
Right. If I am the ruler, how on earth do I stop my own administrators, my governors, and my police force from using this absolute power to overthrow me?
That's the million-dollar question.
Because they are human, too. Which means, according to legalist theory, they are also selfish and looking to maximize their own profit.
And that is the crucial vulnerability of any bureaucracy. An official might use the power of fire to enrich themselves or build a faction against the ruler.
So how do you control?
To manage the officials, the ruler cannot just use public laws. The ruler needs a different tool set entirely. This introduces the second pillar of legalism, shoo.
Okay, shoo, which is translated as administrative techniques or methods.
Yes.
And this concept is heavily attributed to a statesman named Shen Buhai, who died around 337 BCE.
That's right. Shen Buhai focused on the internal mechanisms of the bureaucracy. Shu is essentially the art of managing subordinates.
So it's for the managers, not the workers.
Exactly. But unlike Fa, which must be clearly publicized so the common people know the rules, Shu must be kept entirely secret by the ruler.
Wait, I am lost. If Fa has to be public so people can follow the rules, why does Shu have to be a secret?
Because if the officials know the specific techniques the ruler is using to evaluate them, they will game the system.
Of course.
They will manipulate the metrics to make themselves look good without actually doing the work. The core of Shu is a technique called Xingming.
Which translates roughly to checking forms against names.
Yes.
Let's break down this concept of names and forms because it feels really central to how this state operates.
Okay, so in a bureaucracy, every official has a name. That's their job title, their job description, or a specific proposal they have made to the ruler. That is the promise.
Okay, the promise is the name.
The form is their actual measurable performance. The ruler's job is to sit back and constantly compare the name to the form.
So if an official claims they can increase grain yields by 10% in their province, that promise is the name.
Right.
If the harvest comes in and it is only a 2% increase, the form does not match the name.
Exactly.
But logistically, how is an ancient ruler auditing this? I mean, they don't have spreadsheets or real-time data feeds.
It required a massive physical bureaucracy of scribes, bamboo tallies, and couriers. The central government dispatched auditors to the provinces to measure granaries, count households, and review local records.
A flow of physical information must have been staggering.
It was immense. The ruler in the capital relied on these audited reports to execute the technique of Xingming. If the form failed to match the name, the official was severely punished.
Okay, that makes sense. Fail to meet your quota, you get punished.
But interestingly, in Hanfei's synthesis of these ideas, the official is also punished if they overperform.
Wait, hold on. I need you to clarify this.
I know, it sounds strange.
If I hire a governor to increase grain yields by 10% and he brings me 20%, I should be thrilled. Why on earth would I punish him for making the state richer? That seems completely counterproductive to the legalist goal of maximizing resources.
From a modern managerial perspective, it does seem counterproductive. But from the perspective of Shu, overperformance indicates that the official is acting outside the boundaries of their assigned name.
So they're doing things they weren't explicitly told to do.
Yes. It suggests they are taking unauthorized initiative.
Because initiative is unpredictable.
Exactly. Unpredictability is dangerous to the mechanical order of the state. An official who overperforms might be squeezing the peasantry too hard to gain undue favor with the ruler, which could spark a rebellion.
Ah, I see. Or they might be building their own independent power base.
Right. The system demands exact adherence to the specified standard. The ruler wants a machine that does exactly what it is calibrated to do, nothing less and nothing more.
So the ruler acts as a purely objective auditor of the bureaucracy. But for this auditing process to carry any weight, for the officials to actually fear the ruler needs the third pillar of legalism.
And that is Shi.
Shi, which is attributed to another thinker, Shen Dao, who lived around the same time as Shen Buhai.
Yes. Shi is translated as positional power, or the momentum of authority.
Momentum of authority. I like that phrasing.
Shen Dao argued that power does not come from the ruler's personal wisdom, their charisma, or their moral virtue. Power resides entirely in the institutional position of the throne itself.
The sources provide a really vivid analogy for this. They compare Shi to a weak driver holding the reins of a strong team of horses.
Yes, it perfectly illustrates the concept.
The horses are vastly stronger than the driver. But the physical weakness of the driver does not matter because the structural position of holding the reins, the institutional apparatus of the chariot, compels the horses to obey.
It is the momentum of the office. Shen Dao pointed out that even a brilliant sage cannot command a single peasant if the sage has no official position.
Right.
But an utterly mediocre man can command a massive empire if he sits on the throne. Therefore, the ruler must fiercely guard the exclusivity of their position.
They must never delegate their ultimate authority, or the momentum will shift to a minister.
Exactly. So we have these three distinct concepts.
Right. Let's recap. Shang Yang gives us Fei, the public algorithms and standards, to control the populace.
Shen Buhai gives us Shu, the secret administrative audits to control the officials.
And Shen Dao gives us Shi, the positional power that validates the whole structure.
And then Han Fei, writing in the 3rd century BCE, synthesizes all three into a single comprehensive theory of statecraft.
Because he saw that you needed all three.
Right. Han Fei saw the flaws in relying on just one. If you have Fa without Shu, the officials will manipulate the laws. If you have Shu without Fa, you have no standards to measure the populace.
And Han Fei adds one more element to this synthesis, pulling from Taoism, which seems really strange given how anti-Taoist the legalists were.
It does, but he incorporates the Taoist concept of Wu Wei,
which translates to non-action.
Yes.
But he completely reinterprets it, right? In Taoism, my understanding is that Wu Wei means aligning yourself with the natural flow of the universe, a kind of spontaneous, peaceful harmony with nature.
Right. But in legalism, Wu Wei becomes a bureaucratic strategy. It means the ruler establishes the laws of Fa, sets the administrative traps of Shu, relies on the positional power of Shi, and then does nothing personally.
The ruler becomes a ghost in the machine.
Exactly. The ruler withdraws from active interference. By doing nothing, the ruler reveals no preferences, no desires, and no weaknesses for the officials to exploit.
So they can't pander to him.
Right. The ruler remains an inscrutable, detached arbiter just watching the machine run itself.
But I have to push back on this a bit.
Sure.
If the system is entirely automated through fear and reward,
right,
and the ruler is actively hiding their true thoughts, sitting behind a veil of secrecy, checking names against forms, doesn't this create a deeply paranoid state?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, the officials are terrified of the ruler, the people are terrifying each other through mutual responsibility, and the ruler trusts absolutely no one. Isn't the ruler ultimately isolated from reality?
That is the psychological cost of the system. Han Fei's writings are characterized by profound paranoia regarding ministerial machinations.
He was worried about getting overthrown.
Constantly. He warns that a ruler's own family, their spouses, their trusted advisors, they are all self-interested actors waiting for a moment of weakness to usurp the Shi, the positional power.
Wow.
The detachment is a defense mechanism. It creates a sterile, high-tension environment devoid of any organic loyalty.
But despite the paranoia it might breed, this exact mechanical system was about to leave the realm of theory.
It was.
It was going to be put into practice on an unprecedented scale.
Yeah.
And it was going to change Chinese history forever. We need to look at how this philosophy actually built an empire.
So we turn our attention back to the state of Qin. Duke Shao of Qin had hired Shang Yang as his chancellor back in 359 BCE.
And Shang Yang implemented the first sweeping legalist reforms.
Yes.
He dismantled the old feudal aristocracy. Mm-hmm. He instituted the grid of mutual responsibility. He tied land and social rank strictly to military and agricultural merit.
And over the next century, those institutional reforms worked exactly as intended. The state of Qin was transformed from a peripheral, somewhat backward state into a highly mobilized agrarian and military powerhouse.
The administration was fully centralized.
Right. The population was continuously channeled into farming and fighting.
They generated a massive caloric surplus to feed their armies. And their soldiers were highly incentivized to fight ruthlessly because, as we discussed, decapitating enemies was the only way to climb the social ladder.
Yes, the system was turning. By the mid-3rd century BCE, Qin possessed an infrastructural and military capacity that the other warring states simply could not match.
And this historical momentum culminated during the reign of King Zheng of Qin.
Exactly. King Zheng came to the throne and, utilizing this legalist war machine, launched a series of final campaigns.
Between 230 and 221 BCE, Qin systematically conquered the remaining independent states.
And in 221 BCE, the warring states period ended. King Zheng had unified China. He declared himself Qin Shi Huang, the first emperor of Qin.
So he had built the empire, but now he had to govern it. And to do that, he relied heavily on his chancellor, a man named Li Si.
Li Si is a really fascinating figure. He had actually studied under the prominent Confucian scholar Sun Zi alongside Han Fei.
Oh, interesting.
But Li Si fully embraced legalist realpolitik. When Qin achieved unification, Li Si was the architect of applying legalist principles on a massive imperial scale.
And the first thing they did was ensure the feudal system could never return. They refused to grant land to the emperor's relatives or successful generals.
Right, no more hereditary kingdoms. Li Si divided the vast new empire into 36 commanderies, which were further subdivided into counties.
And these regions were administered by centrally appointed officials, right?
Yes, officials who could be promoted, transferred, or executed based purely on their performance metrics.
It is the ultimate application of Fa and Shu.
It really is.
But to make this bureaucracy work across millions of square kilometers, Li Si recognized that everything had to be standardized. The variety of local customs and systems across all these conquered states was a threat to the algorithm.
Standardization was absolute and immediate. The Qin government standardized weights and measures,
which is crucial for collecting consistent tax revenues.
Exactly. If a local governor uses a larger scoop to collect grain tax from the peasants and a smaller standard scoop to send that grain to the capital, the governor skims the difference.
Right.
Standardizing the physical weights and measures eliminates that specific avenue of corruption.
They standardize coinage as well. And they even standardized the width of chariot axles, which I thought was a really interesting detail.
It might sound trivial, but it was a brilliant logistical move.
Why is that?
Well, the dirt roads across the empire were deeply rutted from centuries of use, especially in the lowest plateau. If your chariot axle did not match the gauge of the ruts in a new territory, your chariot would literally break down.
It just wouldn't fit in the tracks.
Right. Standardizing the axle width meant that military forces and supply wagons could move rapidly anywhere in the territory without having to switch vehicles.
And perhaps most significantly, they standardized the written script. They mandated the use of the small seal script across the empire, eliminating all the regional variations in writing.
And this is massive. This meant an edict from the capital could be read and enforced identically by an official 1,000 miles away, regardless of what spoken dialect that official used.
These infrastructural and bureaucratic achievements were just staggering. They organized forced labor on a monumental scale, too.
Yes. For instance, the Zengo Canal, which was completed in 246 BCE just prior to unification, it irrigated vast tracts of the Guanzhong Plain.
And the texts say it boosted grain yields by 40%. That provided the immense economic base necessary for sustained conquest and control.
It is a testament to the sheer organizing power of legalism.
It is. But this relentless drive for control and standardization also led to one of the most infamous events in Chinese history, the burning of the books.
Right. In 213 BCE, Chancellor Li Si presented a memorial to the emperor arguing that the private possession of classical texts, historical records of rival states, and philosophical writings was a direct threat to state security.
So he ordered all such books to be burned.
He did, exempting only practical manuals on agriculture, medicine, and divination, as well as the historical records of the state of Qin itself.
Now, relying strictly on our sources, we really need to view this objectively through the lens of legalist logic.
Mm-hmm.
Li Si was not just acting out of, you know, cartoonish villainy.
No, from his perspective, it was a practical necessity.
Because the Confucians and other scholars were constantly using historical precedents, tales of ancient sage kings, to criticize the current regime's harsh methods.
Yes, using the past to criticize the present. In a legalist system, where Fa must be the sole standard of truth and behavior, ideological diversity is a destabilizing variable.
Right.
Permitting scholars to debate alternative modes of governance undermines the absolute authority, the Xi, of the centralized state.
So to Li Si, eradicating the books was simply an act of ideological standardization, no different than standardizing the written script or the chariot axles.
Exactly. It was about monopolizing the narrative to ensure total compliance. The state machine was running at maximum capacity. They were building palaces, extending the Great Wall, moving hundreds of thousands of troops to the frontiers.
The Qin had created the ultimate state machinery, unified a vast territory, and seemingly secured power for generations.
And yet, this mighty empire, which had spent over a century building its power, would collapse entirely in just 15 years.
15 years. It is a stunning historical whiplash. By 207 BCE, the Qin dynasty was gone. So how does the perfect machine tear itself apart?
Well, the collapse was driven by the sheer weight and rigidity of the legalist system itself. The scale of mobilization that legalism enabled also allowed for unprecedented exploitation.
The sources mention that hundreds of thousands of peasants were conscripted for massive labor projects. The Yapang Palace, the huge tomb for the first emperor, the frontier walls.
Right. And the taxation required to fund the state apparatus reached crushing levels, with some estimates suggesting up to 60% of a peasant's harvest was seized by the state.
60%. That is incredible.
The populace was exhausted, starving, and living in constant terror of the severe penalties of Fa.
Which brings us to a narrative vignette from the text that I think perfectly illustrates the fatal flaw of the system. It is the story of Chen Sheng in 209 BCE.
Oh, this is a crucial event. Chen Sheng and a man named Wu Guang were commoners acting as military officers, and they were tasked with escorting a group of conscripts to a garrison assignment.
And they ran into heavy rain and flooding, making the roads impassable. They realized they were going to be late arriving at their destination.
And under Qin law, Fa was absolute and inflexible. There were no excuses, no mitigating circumstances, no consideration of intent. The penalty for arriving late for military duty was execution.
So Chen Sheng and Wu Guang are sitting there in the mud, basically looking at the algorithm of the law. If they proceed and arrive late, they die. If they desert, they die.
It is like when a software program hits a fatal error because of an edge case the programmer did not foresee.
Yes. The system crashed because it lacked an if-then exception for bad weather.
So they mutinied. Chen Sheng is recorded as asking his fellow conscripts, "Kings and nobles kill us anyway. Why not become kings ourselves?"
They literally had nothing to lose.
Yeah.
Because the punishment was absolute and unbending, the system created its own executioners.
It did. This specific event sparked a massive rebellion that quickly engulfed the empire. And it highlights a profound theoretical failure in the legalist model, one that modern scholars have spent a great deal of time analyzing.
Yeah, the sources introduce a modern critique of this failure, referencing scholars like Patrick Deneen and Aaron Wolyatt. They actually draw a connection between ancient legalism and modern liberalism.
It sounds counterintuitive, but the connection lies in their shared foundational assumption about human nature.
Right.
Both legalism and modern liberalism, in its economic and political theories, tend to reduce human beings to purely rational, self-interested, utility-maximizing individuals, homo economicus.
The legalists built their entire state on the assumption that if you just set the incentives correctly, rewards for obedience, horrific punishments for disobedience rational actors will always calculate that it is in their best interest to obey.
Right. They attempted to govern purely through these mechanical incentives. They explicitly rejected the Confucian idea of building a moral community, of fostering organic loyalty or shared values.
And here's the rational choice failure. When you govern exclusively through extreme punitive incentives, you actually change the rational calculus in a dangerous way.
As Wolyatt's analysis suggests, if the penalty for a minor infraction like being late due to a flood is the exact same as the penalty for high treason, the state has inadvertently equalized the risk.
If I am going to be executed for being tardy, I might as well try to overthrow the emperor. The risk is the same, but the potential reward of treason is becoming a king.
Treason becomes a highly rational choice.
I want to bring back the zero tolerance workplace metaphor we established earlier. Imagine a manager who institutes a draconian policy. If an employee is 5 minutes late, they are immediately terminated.
Okay.
The manager thinks this will create a perfectly punctual workforce. But what actually happens?
Well, if an employee hits unexpected traffic and realizes they will be 6 minutes late, they know they are already fired, so they simply will not show up at all.
Exactly. They might even steal company property on the way out because the maximum penalty has already been triggered.
The system's own rigidity becomes its undoing. By refusing to allow for nuance, intent, or human reality, the legalist algorithm drove the population into a corner where rebellion was the only logical output.
So the Qin dynasty shattered under the pressure of its own unyielding structure. Following the death of Qin Shi Huang in 210 BCE, palace intrigue, driven by the very self-interest and paranoia legalism cultivated, crippled the central leadership.
Right. The eunuch Zhao Gao orchestrated purges, the new emperor was inept, and the rebellions, sparked by men like Chen Sheng, tore the empire apart by 207 BCE.
Well, while the Qin dynasty burned, the machinery they built did not. The underlying legalist operating system was simply too effective for subsequent rulers to throw away.
And this is the phenomenon we can call the ghost in the machine, legalism's enduring legacy.
Let's talk about the dynasty that emerged from the ashes of the Qin, which was the Han dynasty. They ruled from 206 BCE to 220 CE. The Han rulers had fought against the tyranny of Qin. They needed legitimacy. So publicly, they loudly repudiated legalism.
They condemned the extreme harshness, the burning of books, the lack of benevolence. Under Emperor Wu in the 2nd century BCE, the Han Dynasty officially installed Confucianism as the state ideology.
So they promoted the ideals of moral virtue, ritual propriety, and benevolent rule.
Publicly, yes. But behind the curtain, they quietly kept almost all of the core legalist bureaucratic structures.
They kind of had to, right? You cannot govern an empire of 60 million people through moral suasion alone.
Exactly. They retained the centralized commanderies. They retained the system of centrally appointed officials. They kept the standardized metrics.
They even kept the legalist system of bureaucratic evaluations. The techniques of Shutu measure official performance.
And they kept a codified system of laws and punishments, Fa, although they did soften the most extreme mutilations to align slightly better with Confucian sensibilities.
This historical synthesis is often described by scholars as having a Confucian substance and legalist function.
Or, to use the phrase of the sources, an outer veneer of Confucian morality masking an inner core of legalist coercion.
It is the ultimate compromise. You preach Confucian virtue to give the state moral legitimacy and foster social harmony, but you use legalist bureaucracy, audits, and penal law to actually run the logistics of the empire.
And this synthesis proved incredibly durable. We can trace this legacy forward for centuries. Look at the Tang Code, promulgated in 653.
The Tang Code is considered one of the most important legal documents in Chinese history, heavily influencing the law of subsequent dynasties in neighboring countries.
Right. And if you analyze the Tang Code, it is a direct blend. It incorporates Confucian moral principles regarding familial hierarchy and filial piety, but it enforces them using the clear, codified, graded penalties derived directly from legalist Fa.
The framework of standardization, the emphasis on written law over arbitrary aristocratic whim, that is the ghost of legalism structuring the empire for over a millennium.
Which brings us to the modern era, where this ancient philosophy is still being reassessed and applied.
And we must maintain strict neutrality here and rely purely on the historical and academic assessments provided in our sources.
Of course.
The sources note that in the mid-20th century, Mao Zedong explicitly praised Qin Shi Huang and his legalist methods.
According to the analysis in the texts, during campaigns in the 1970s, legalism was elevated as a progressive, centralizing force that historically fought against reactionary aristocratic elements.
Elements which were associated with Confucianism.
Right. Mao admired the first emperor's ability to unify the nation and suppress ideological dissent, seeing parallels with the need for a strong, centralized authority to drive rapid societal transformation.
Moving into the 21st century, the sources draw comparisons between legalist administrative techniques and modern data-driven governance. Specifically, they mention systems like the social credit framework.
The academic analysis points out that such systems utilize massive data collection to monitor behavior, a modern manifestation of surveillance.
Right.
They employ a system of rewards for compliance and restrictions or punishments for infractions, designed to align individual behavior with the state's macroeconomic and social goals.
It is basically a digital realization of Shu administrative techniques of tracking performance and fake clear standards of behavior.
The rhetoric surrounding these modern systems often focuses on building trust and social harmony, which has Confucian echoes. But the mechanics using incentives and disincentives to empirically shape human action without relying on voluntary moral goodness share a theoretical lineage with the strategies articulated by Han Fei and Xiang Yang.
What does this all mean for us? I want to pose a question directly to you, the listener. Think about the massive, highly organized bureaucracies you interact with today. Whether it is a global corporation tracking your productivity metrics, a financial institution calculating your credit score, or an algorithm modifying your content on social media based on a set of hidden rules.
Yeah, think about how those systems operate.
When you look at these systems, how much of their operation actually relies on human empathy, moral virtue, or individual context? And how much of it is just the ghost of legalism, impersonal performance standards, automated incentives, and the cold calculation of checking names against forms?
It is a sobering reflection. We like to believe our institutions are founded on ethical principles. But structurally, the demand for efficiency and scale often pushes organizations toward legalist methodologies.
We started this deep dive talking about blueprints and machines. The legalists believe that human nature is fundamentally self-interested. They looked at the chaos of the warring states and concluded that morality was a fragile illusion and that only strict laws and raw power could enforce order. Their solution was a mechanical state that ultimately crushed itself with its own rigidity. Yet, the bureaucratic innovation survived. If human nature truly does possess that core of self-interest, as Hanfei believed, is every complex society eventually forced to build a legalist framework of incentives and deterrents just to survive? Regardless of the lofty moral philosophies a society claims to uphold on the surface, does the inherent tension between how we wish humans behaved and how they actually behave guarantee that the mechanics of legalism will always exist in the shadows of civilization? If we want the machine to run, do we eventually have to turn off our humanity? Thank you for listening. History Maps. Learn history visually.